I listed the questions that you raised in the presentation here, so that there's, if you'd like to spend the question and answer time going over these first, or shall we respond to these first, or?
Go ahead, if there's questions, go ahead.
Okay.
Scott, this was thanks very much. This was a suggestion. In looking at the square footage of the CMRR versus the CMR, look at the square footage of the existing CMR and its existing missions. A lot of that square footage has already been shut down in the existing building, and a lot is soon to be shut down. And this is a kind of a big mystery as to just what's being replaced here, and I think that will expand on your analysis and make it even better.
Response to that?
Yes, please. Yes, thank you, Greg. Yes, many of the wings, maybe three or four of the existing wings of the existing CMR building are presently empty and have been shut down. Thank you.
Other questions relating to the presentation?
My name is Eric Kirshner, and I'm an economist, and I want to thank Scott for the presentation, and I'm especially interested in his thoughts on, what thought has been given to making the nuclear facility smaller. And in that respect, I want to expand and just tell a little story. And I think what I was really troubled with, and I addressed this issue in the EIS and under the NEPA statement, and I just didn't get a satisfactory response. And I learned my economics under Armin Alchian and all that bunch at UCLA, worked at RAND initially. And the first thing that you learn when you're an Alchian student is anytime you see a need, look at it as being an obfuscation in terms of what the conclusion being reached before the analysis has been done. And, you know, like he says, originally the CMRR, Congress determined it wasn't required unless a reliable warhead was to be needed. And so I'm just really troubled by not being able to get economists or social science in this thing. And to give you the story back to when I first worked on my EIS for Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill's Environmental Study Group on the Mount Hood Freeway, the Federal Highway Administration was adamant that we limit the use of our funds to a freeway solution. There was congestion coming in from East Portland on I-80N, and we fought tooth and nails and said, no, the NEPA says that you have to look at a no-build. There has never been a facility that has a weapons component, and looking at it in a broad sense. And we were able to argue that land use was a substitute, communication was a substitute, light rail was a substitute. There are many other ways to solve the congestion problem, and as a result, the freeway was never built, and we had a better solution. So I'm just troubled and just wondering why we're going ahead with this project without utilizing economists to do a social analysis, and we're still talking needs rather than really articulating what the supply and demand for this facility is.
The question was asking you to comment on that.
Anybody's free to look at it at any time. The question is, you know, what do you do with that information? You know, the information would have to be taken to your congressmen, to your senators, and, you know, lobbying like that. The social and economic impacts, you know, and requirements of this building, you know, we've been discussing, you know, at these meetings for a while now, and, you know, the need for the facility is still, in my mind, questionable.
Other questions, sir?
Dan Williams with Bridge and Moore. Thank you very much for your presentation. Am I to understand when I look at this graph here, all of that funds that's being given to the nuclear weapons activities are 65%. If we maybe even just move about half of that down to the renewable energy, we all would have electricity.
Dot comment?
Yes, it's been our you know, many of our positions that people at the lab could do other things with the money. We are especially believe that the laboratory would be really good at nuclear non-proliferation.
Scott, just one other comment about this, about making the nuclear facility smaller. and about the 2002 mission need. It was pretty clear in 2002 that, I mean, I think you condensed what you're trying to say a little bit, and so it didn't all come out, but there really wasn't any mission need in 2002 either. There was a stated mission need, but making RRWs, but of course there wasn't a need to make RRWs, and so there wasn't the mission need for the building. On the matter of making a smaller nuclear facility, it gets hard, as you know. Building is something, the labs are something like 8% of the square footage of the building. It begins to be all shell and no nut. And it's an interesting question, I think, from Eric's perspective, what is the real benefit of this building? Just even, I mean, when you get to a building where it's nearly all concrete, structure, utilities, fans, equipment, and there's very little actual usable space in the building left, and it has to be built that way so it can be safe, then you really, that's a, should be a signal then to go back to Eric's question and say, maybe we should look at this whole thing de novo again. I think it's probably quite hard to shrink.
Yes, thank you, Greg. I agree with you. I'm still not even convinced that the facility, the operations that are planned for the new nuclear facility can be absorbed in the existing rad lab and the existing plutonium facility. And we haven't really seen those numbers or been shown that demonstrated to us how those numbers cannot work yet.
Only one question.
Again, we're back to the money I'm looking at here. I worked at Lawrence Berkeley Laboratories in California for a while. I'm also a G6 certified welder. What I'm kind of looking at here is all of this money that's being spent to build something new when you haven't fixed things that are here at this lab throughout, mostly having to do with welding, which we posted on our website, welds that are ridiculous and dangerous. I think what you need to do is fix what you've got now before you build any more.
Is there a question or response there?
Steve Long, as well noted, I heard your statement.
Okay. Jay Coughlin, Nuke Watch, New Mexico. Concerning the question of whether the nuclear facility should be built or not, I'll always remain convinced that the programmatic driver for the nuclear facility is expanded plutonium pit production. And the fiscal 11 budget tells us that production of the W88 pits is going to be come to a close in fiscal year 11. There is no clear need for expanded pit production, or even going beyond the less than 10 that the laboratory is doing now. And my understanding that the main mission of the nuclear facility is to do the analytical chemistry. And in turn, for each pit that is produced, there can be even up to 100 analytical chemistry samples conducted. So if you keep the level of pit production down, the need for AC goes down exponentially. And then we already know that in response to the Defense Nuclear Facility Safety Board, that materials characterization has already been transferred to PF4 from CMR. And then again, assuming that non-proliferation programs could largely be absorbed in the rad lab, I just see no mission need for the nuclear facility. And I know that the folks here don't have the high pay grades to address these policy issues, but this is something that's always lacking at these meetings. And these immense projects costing multiple billions just seem to roll on without any clear mission need. So,
Joni Ahrens, Concerned Citizens for Nuclear Safety. I met with the DNFSB this afternoon, and we were talking about the need for the capacity study that we've been asking for a number of years with regard to if this building's even needed or not. And they were surprised to learn that at one of these meetings, several of these meetings in the early days, that we were asking that the rad lab be built in such a way that if the nuclear facility wasn't built, that you would be able to have the capacity to do what you needed to do. So I just want to put that in the notes tonight, that the public asked the Department of Energy a long time ago to make sure that the RAD lab was up to a Cat 1 facility, so that if the nuclear facility wasn't built, that we wouldn't be having these arguments. We're here to help you in the decision making. And frankly, I'm very concerned by the fact that you're going to do lay down work without getting a permit. And I think that that challenges our settlement agreement. I don't think that that's in good faith in terms of what we negotiated several years ago. And I'm very concerned about that, because I think that it's not what we had talked about earlier. So I would like to sit down with you all and talk about that. And I think the other interested parties would like to talk to you about that as well.
My name is Stephanie Hiller, this goes back to earlier in the presentation. I'd like to ask Steve, when you were asked about the escalating costs of nuclear weapons work at the lab, you said it was driven by the president's budget, that the president had made that decision. And so it sounded like, the chief made the decision and the lab was merely complying. But my question is, who really determines what is the work of the lab? Is it the president's decision or the lab's, lobbying for funding for projects that it has in mind?
Okay. The programmatic requirements for the facilities with the Office of Defense Programs within NNSA. So they set the requirements set for the laboratory and for the project. So the minister of NNSA and the head of Office of Defense Programs, they set. So there are individuals responsible for the mission set.
That's what I thought. So in effect, it's the lab that is in those people at NSA that are influencing policy decisions that may be made by the president, but they have significant input. Is that correct?
Well, absolutely. These are federal people at headquarters in Washington who work with Congress and a lot of the other of our clients who receive our product to figure out what is necessary for the nation.
We're clear with the follow-ons, the direct follow-ons to the presentation. Ready to move into the questions that Scott raised? Okay.
This is Rick. So major sources of cost increases, and I'm not going to necessarily bin these in numerical order, but I'm going to try to articulate a couple of where the drivers come from. One is time. At CD0, the nuke facility was to be done in 2012. And so the time spent waiting on making decisions and continuing work is a manifestation of the decision process, the pause for complex transformation while things went on and all those kind of things. Time is a big driver, and it manifests itself not just in the carrying cost, but because everything costs more the further you move out in time. So time is a pretty big component in that algorithm in terms of where costs come. Another source cost in the job comes from implementation of the seismic requirements. And I think they're getting pretty close to zeroing in. The deviations that we get now from these reports as they come out is much, much smaller than it used to be. We've done the big jump in response from the building as the 10-year update is. We made the building stiffer, increased the amount of concrete inside of the building. We will replace the soil underneath the building. It is easier and more certain in terms of an activity as opposed to testing a jet grouting process and proving to everybody that the jet grouting works and would be the subject of the next 22 of these meetings that we would have. I think it's on an order of magnitude of about 50 feet. It's 225,000 cubic yards. So we will put in piers around the outer shell and then excavate out, and it takes all that material away. So we go down to what is known to be stable, and I think it's an additional 50 feet beyond where the basement is. Tom's nodding his head up and down, so I think I got that pretty close to right. So if you take where the current road is, you've been by the site, that's where the current excavation is, we're going to go another 75 or so feet below that, replace the material, build it up to where the base mat is, 10-foot thick base mat, and then build the structure on top of that.
125,000 cubic yards of material to go.
Some of that will become the cap for MDAC. Some of that will support the cap down at Area G, depending upon, again, the quality of the fill and how much work it has to have. But there are plenty of users and needs to benefit the area from that material. So those are the two places that have said we need it. I think the timing's going to work pretty well for MDAC once they come up with a plan, because they don't have a full-up plan yet that they've got agreed to. But some of it go there, and then if not, if they don't, if they're not ready for it, it probably all can be consumed down for cap at Area G. And I don't know anything about the cap at Area G. I just know they need dirt.
Is any of that soil contaminated? Have you measured it for radionuclides, heavy metals, volatiles?
So we are down in time, in geologic time, we are looking at about 10 to 50 million years ago in time. So I don't think, I know there's been soil samples done. I don't think they found anything of that type. We're way below the depth of any man-made activity.
225,000 cubic yards of soil removed. What will that be replaced with? And that's obviously more than 130,000 cubic yards of concrete.
Yeah, this is Rick, and I'll probably just keep bouncing back and forth in terms of, I'm the guy who sounds like Dan Aykroyd. So, or he sounds like me. So the plan today is we'll replace it with lean concrete. So that's, you know, that's concrete without stone. And that'll give us an adequate, it's got Portland cement and sand and water and essentially all the right materials, no aggregate in it. That will provide an adequate certainty of the characteristics so that any question that someone would ask in terms of, well, how do you know what's going on underneath the building is okay. So that is not part of the 130,000 cubic yards of structural concrete in the building, but it would also come from a batch plant-type operation. So back on...
Rick, just a clarifying question. So where are those reports? Where's your work plan? How do we get a hold of it to be able to review it?
So we are putting together that design now. So it's still in process. In fact, engineers were in my office today where I approved of the release of the design work. So that'll be a future activity. And as we get that, we'll come in and talk about it. When it's ready, but it's going to be it'll be late this calendar year by the time they're done. By the time they're done with it. But the answer is yes.
How large of an earthquake is this facility supposed to stand up to?
Tom Whitaker here with Los Alamos Site Office. So the simplest answer is about a 1 in 2,500 year earthquake event. If you consider flood events, the 1 in 100 year flood. It's about a 1 in 2,500 year earthquake event.
Question.
Are we saying 9.5?
No, somewhere. The way the process works, I ballpark it somewhere around a magnitude 7.
That's low. I was in California with a couple of them. That's low.
So this is the 1 in 2,500 year event determined by the process.
You're playing with a 7?
There's different geology there than here.
This is Rick back to. Back to the list from Scott.
What is that going to cost?
To remove the fill?
To remove the fill, go down 50 feet, put in lean concrete.
I haven't split that out from the overall estimate, but I can get that for you next time. In the tens of millions.
And is this under the design work?
The design, yeah, the design. Yeah, it's a portion of the design. So as we went through and answered questions and thought about what is the building response going to be, what is that shelf going to look like if the earthquake should occur, we made the decision that said it is in the right interest of the project, just like we decided to make the base mat be 10 feet thick as opposed to 5 feet thick, which was in the original plan, in order to give us certainty in the building response, also to recognize that we're designing this building for a 50-year life, also with recognition that we have equipment that has to continue to operate during the earthquake event and after the earthquake event, that we want the building and the response to be as minimum as can be contemplated by design activities, so that you can increase the likelihood that you can get that equipment and have it run right, and you're going to be right should that activity occur. So the design of that work is part of the design, but the total cost of that effort is in the tens of millions, if you ask me for a ballpark. I'm going to stick with tens of millions for right now. Should I, you want to go back to Scott's or go here?
Let's go here real quick, okay. And we'll go back to Scott's.
This is just a real short question. I think it's directed towards Dr. Tim Nelson, I believe, or someone from NASA, NNSA. Is there any way that someone could share an economist or group of economists that are working on this thing to give us the insurance that the best interests of the nation are looked at in a broad sense and it's not driven slowly? I mean, someone that would be willing to collaborate and so we can look at this issue in a national, in a broader national interest?
Yeah, I think I should probably address that one. This project is about the scope, cost, and schedule, and we're going to provide you the best information that goes on with the project, how we developed, how much it's going to cost, what our contingencies are, what are we looking at in terms of risks. But in terms of economies over a national scale and some things at a broader scope, is far beyond me in that sense. Yeah, and
I think you misunderstood my question. I'm talking in terms of the demand for this thing, because needs to me is basically stating that we're not going to justify this project. When you use the term needs, that precludes any rational discussion of whether there is a mission or demand for this thing. So I just want to know if there's economists working on it at some point that we can touch base, that economists for security can touch base with.
Looking at Tim, and he's not knowing that I'm saying this, like,
I will post that as a question.
Uncertain at this time.
In the interest of making sure we get through the questions that are already posed in the room, why don't we let Rick finish going through those questions, then we can take the follow-on questions, the other follow-on questions. But rather than leave these questions kind of hanging until the next meeting if we run out of time. Does that sound fair? Okay,
so we were still, we had made it through half of one question thus far. So other sources of cost increase. So I started to talk about the seismic response of the building and the equipment, and that led to a number of things, making that'll show up in the extent of the amount of concrete, the amount of structural steel for overhead structures, for supporting ventilation duct, the thickness of the ventilation duct itself, and a whole host of other sources of things inside of the design of the building itself. So seismic response and making sure that we have that right, so that when the earth shakes, the building responds in a known fashion according to the design, so that the equipment that has to operate will still operate during and after the seismic event. That's another big source of cost inside the totality of the estimate that is driven by, and you'll see it in a lot of host of different commodities. I'm trying to think if there's any other. This job has got a lot of ventilation duct in it. This job has a lot of electrical conduit and cable. Does not have a lot of pipe in it. The building did get larger in size for the utility structure. Remember, this building is three structures on a common base mat. You have the auxiliary portion of the building, which houses the fire water tanks and other utilities that cleared people but not operators have to get to, or gold box operators. You have the HAZCAT 2 structure itself, which has the laboratories in it, and then you have the vault. So I don't think the vault's ever going to get any smaller or going to change in terms of size. The laboratory footprint, which is a major portion of the building structure, if you started to remove individual laboratories, said I don't want that capability, Greg's point's right, that the building's not going to change much in terms of size if you do that, because it's full in the basement with the ventilation system and the utility structure that's above that. When the building went from 40,000 square feet of laboratory space down to the 22,500 square feet of laboratory space that's in there today, you might have been able to at that point, but no one had a design for that structure, been able to contemplate, yes, if I take away, then it could get smaller. The utility structure of the auxiliary building, we did make bigger from an operations and a constructability review because we had stuff that was just packed too tight. So I've already had looking at the design to make sure that there's room to get the valves and get the gauges and do the right work that has to be done inside of there. We had maintenance people from TA 55. I brought in external maintenance people. I had construction people look at it to make sure that they felt like that there was adequate clearance. And as part of that exercise, I made that building a little bit bigger to give them the room that they thought they needed to get the stuff. Now, it's going to be full because they always wind up full. So we have done some of those things to make the building footprint bigger. I think we're at the point where we're about to freeze that portion of the design so that it's not going to change very much at all from here. I'm not going to get into the comparisons to other facilities because we could have that discussion for a really long time in terms of what footprint do I count. Because I'm building a training center, do I count the training complex that's in Los Alamos town that I'm going to not use anymore as part of the footprint and all that stuff? But I think our footprint is pretty much getting close to being stable in terms of size and others in terms of things. That was a source of change as we did go through some things. The in the contingency number, in the data sheet that NNSA had sent, they're showing that number at about $700 million of contingency. At this stage of a project, having 25 or 30% contingency in your plan is smart. If I came in here and told you, I know everything I need to know to go build this job, you should have me fired. Because I don't. Nobody can. And so having that contingency, that was not an offer, by the way. Joni's back there laughing. I mean, it's... so, well, because this is a very large job. This is a big building with a lot of things in it. There will be a large number of construction people to build this building. And so when you talk about contingency in terms of a percentage, 25, 30% at this stage of a job is about what you ought to have. And your point is right. As you get forward and move forward in those baselines, that contingency number should go down. And when I look at the estimate, I say, okay, I had a number in contingency, but I now have put into my estimate the work that is intended to avoid that bad outcome from happening, so therefore my contingency number should go down as you move forward in the process. And I think it has changed. At this point, you're not stable enough to say whether or not the contingency should go down, but you should see that occur in subsequent budgets submitted by DOE, et cetera. You would see numbers go into the base estimate and come out of contingency. It's not intended to hide things. It's just the way that these work out. The batch plant is in, not in OPC, the batch plant is in the capital cost. So it's in the cost of the nuclear facility. Because you need to mobilize the plant, that's part of that cost. You gotta buy aggregate, you gotta make the concrete, you gotta deliver the concrete. And one of the reasons to do this is to take the time sensitive, you know, getting stone up to the hill, because there isn't one pebble that's on the hill today that goes into new facility construction. So therefore, everything has to come up the hill, and by putting the warehouse inside of the security corridor, by putting the batch plant inside of the security corridor, the intent is to minimize the time sensitivity as to when that material shows up, and so that you get it in at the hours when you don't impact traffic as much and all those kind of things, and therefore the time-sensitive items, delivery of concrete, because once you make it, you got to use it. In terms of having that inside of that security corridor. So cost of the batch plant is inside of the base number. There were a whole number of studies that I think others can share in terms of, and I'm not sure how they are, but there's been a whole number of studies done looking at how can it be made, could it be made smaller, looking at the missions and all those kind of things. Seismic measures, I think we're getting pretty stable in terms of where the design comes in and the spectrum, and we know how to go deal with that. And the new facility still will be LEED certified. Though to get a Hazcat 2, just a plain vanilla LEED. I'm not going for gold, silver, anything else right now. I think right now in my plan, I do have 27 points. I've had somebody external to the project come and review that to make sure that we were doing the smart things to get there from here. And we did not have to make a whole lot of change to get there. Things were being done in a pretty good fashion to get there from this particular point in time. So, and we have actually, registered the new facility in the LEED system so that we were under the current structure that's out there, because they're changing all the, they're changing those criteria all the time. So we are registered for the new facility into that to get to LEED.
The offset factor.
That's part of what I try to as the guy responsible for delivering this, the footprint, you could talk in terms of a whole host of different things, in terms of things. I don't know, I'm not sure I've seen this table or I can remember seeing this table. Came from?
The data sheet.
Oh, it came from the data sheet, okay.
It's my table.
So, Steve did that, okay.
It's my table. Oh.
So, I think we're pretty close to stability in terms of the numbers overall, and again, you could talk about, you know, again, do I take the training center out of town and all those kind of things in there? You could make that story kind of go either way, I think.
I think the story is that in terms of programmatic space, if you look at, and we tried doing this in pie charts last time and time before, and we end up comparing apples and oranges, but the numbers I kind of judge was, there's about 130,000 gross square feet of current programmatic space in CMR. We're pricing 19.5 in radiological space and 22.5 in the nuclear facility. So that's roughly about, what's it, 40,000 square feet? So there's programmatically, the amount of programmatic space is going down significantly. But the requirements for all of the safety systems that we have to design on in makes this nut rather, as Greg noted, rather large and robust. So that is reduction in programmatic space, greater footprint. But then again, when you start adding apples and oranges, in the nuclear facility, or we're adding in interstitial space, whether or not that's actual operating space and stuff in the basement that you typically don't go in, but it does have a floor and walls, count that as hard space. So there are things that really go into that equation that makes it an apple and orange type of comparison.
Okay, we have about 5 minutes left. I've got two people right now in the queue for questions, three, so.
Yes. Looking at this, Dave McCoy, looking at this from a legal perspective, it seems to me that when you're talking about excavating this large volume of material, and it seems that you have basically changing designs, changing awareness and recognition of seismic hazards that weren't previously identified. You've got new traffic concerns, new air concerns. It just seems to me that you need to take another look at least a supplement to your EA. You need to redo it. You need to reopen it to the public. There's plenty of public concern here. You can't deny that. I think you need to be looking at the EIS for this business. You know, you've got some substantial changes that you've made here.
That's the question.
Cindy, we have an EIS for the CMR facility, 2004, I think I want to say November or February. I get those dates.
February.
5 years. And then that looked at the construction impacts for the facility in terms of its programmatic need, where it fits. That's looked at in the LANL SWICE in terms of the impacts overall to the institution, and then the programmatic impacts were looked at in the complex transformation. So a lot of NEPA going on. Heard your statement, heard your point. Thank you.
Two last questions?
This is a sort of, I guess, a hypothetical question. Oh, yeah, my name is Jalaluddin. And I'm a graduate of the University of California. So assuming that there was some sanity in the Department of Energy and the NNSA, how much solar panels or wind farms would we be able to create if we didn't want to spend $5 billion to build this new facility to build nuclear weapons?
That's a good question.
Maybe next time you can come up with the answer.
Comparison.
I'm a little concerned that you've already begun digging for the nuclear facility, and to me that seems like it should be part of the construction costs, and that can't happen, is according to our agreement, I don't think that should have happened yet. And I was one of those involved many hours in negotiations, and so that upsets me. Then I have a request. Is there some reason why the proceedings of these meetings can't be on the website within a week or two? Because, we can't take notes fast as people talk. And then to get it many months later, it's like it's gone from our mind, what we've been doing here. And so I would like to request that you try to get it on the website fast.
In terms of the first area, in terms of the laydown area where what's adjacent to the radiological facility, we needed to clear that space to construct the rad lab. During that time, we utilized that time wisely, and we did a lot of geophysical mapping for faults and other things. So we gained a lot of information that drove the risks down, so we knew what we're supposed to build in terms of for seismic requirements and seismic responses for the nuclear facility. In terms of getting out the transcriptions out on the web sooner, we agree that we should try to get those out as quickly as possible. No apologies for the last time. It's just that our favorite transcriber over here broke her wrist, and it's a little bit hard to whip somebody and when they got a cast on. So we understand that. We'll try to get that out as soon as reasonable. Sooner rather than later is understood, and that we'll take our best effort at it. Okay.
Folks, it's now 8:31. We're a minute over time. I apologize. I have one last request for you. Those of you who came in and missed the sign-up sheet, will you please sign it on the way out so that we have a good full record of attendance? And I will make sure that the questions and comments are provided to Lanel, and we'll see you at the next meeting. Thank you very much.